Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I've signed and I've stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So you could just see
600,000, deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor." Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for two straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes. I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you're finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, I learned this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And Master Ronnie saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cat. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
By the time you met Blondon, how big were you getting? Like, how much were you buying on a regular basis?
Oh, no, maybe a couple pounds, 16 pounds maybe.
16 pounds.
Yeah, 8 pounds, something like that. Okay. At that time, pounds were going for 35,000 a pound, yeah.
By the time you met Blondon, how much cash did you have?
I don't know. I had a few hundred thousand.
A few hundred thousand. So you weren't a millionaire back then, but you were well off.
I was doing good.
You were doing good.
I was doing pretty good.
So how did the whole Blondon thing come together?
Well, see, we were still getting from the Blondon, but we wasn't going directly to Blondon.
It was a middleman.
It was a middleman. So the only thing happened when we.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. A man who taught many wonderful truths about life once said, make the most of your present opportunities. Make the most of your present opportunities. Let me repeat once again. Make the most of your present opportunities. And the longer I live, the more convinced I am, this is a wonderful piece of advice. Appreciate the present before it becomes the past. Make the most of your present opportunities. So many of us waste our present time worrying about the past or the future. And actually, we can do nothing about either the past or the future. Little sympathy or patience should be wasted on the person who is eternally crying for the good old days,
or bemoaning that things aren't as they used to be. Naturally, they aren't. Time changes all things, as it is changing you right now. And were it not for change, there could be no progress in this world of ours. Probably a good bit of advice to all of us would be to live every moment as it comes to us, just as though it were the only one we had on earth. To appreciate the present before it becomes the past. Let your life be filled now with love, with happiness, with harmony, with courage, with faith. Too many of us are wasting energy trying to relive the past. And we are putting off our good from day to day, from month to month, and from year to year, so that we never quite catch up with it. Why not live now? Forget the troubles of the past and stop dreading the future. The expression of our powers and abilities is governed by our thoughts. If our thoughts are dwelling in the past or in the future, our power and abilities will be lessened in the present, because they will be trying to follow our thoughts to realms that do not exist. We need all our abilities right now in the present moment. We cannot afford to dissipate them by letting our mind dwell on the past or by worrying about the future. If we live rightly every present moment, we shall have no occasion to mourn over the past. What does it really matter today what happened yesterday or some other day in the past? It is beyond our recall, so it is not worth the effort of worrying about it. Dr. Frank Crane expressed a bit of good philosophy on this matter in his short article called The Past. Says Dr. Crane, "A good deal of morbid nonsense has been said and written and thought about the past. The past is irrevocable. We have been told in sermon and story, you cannot escape the past. The past can never be changed." And so on and so on. The whole trend of this thought being that the past is a kind of a Sherlock Holmes, dogging our steps forever, a sinister nemesis, waiting its chance to strike us down, the account book of an angry God, sure to confront us someday. All of this is morbid. Most of it is dramatic. The underlying sentiment of it is false and weakening and septic. As a matter of fact, our past, as Maeterlinck puts it so well, depends on our present and changes with it. Our past depends on our present and changes with it. What the past is depends upon the way you are now using it. Its effect upon your destiny will be gauged by how you translate it into the future. If we brood over the past and weaken ourselves with vain regret, with self-contempt and remorse, then that past will poison and undo us in the present. But no matter what the past contains of our sin or folly, we can, by a right use of it now, make it minister to our welfare. First of all, we can learn wisdom from the past. By it, we can realize our faults to be corrected and our offenses to be atoned for. And with this wisdom, we can go on to better things. The only true repentance is so to use the past as to enable us to build a better future. Weeping and wailing and brooding, those are the luxuries of morbidity. The past is beneath our feet. We can go down into it and wallow in impotent grief, or we can step upon that past to higher things. The great enemy of life is despair. The great friend is hope. Despair paralyzes, ruins. Hope energizes, for we are saved by hope. Face the future. Whatever the past has been, let it nerve you to spend your remaining days in faithfulness and loyalty to your better self. These are the words of Dr. Frank Crane, and I feel he certainly has the right view. Be concerned about your past only to the extent that it can teach you. The mistakes and sorrows of yesterday belong to yesterday. Yesterday provided sufficient time in which to consider its woes. Most of the worries, the griefs, the heartaches that we suffer are nothing more or less than memory of the troubles and hurts that we experienced some time in the past. If we could only remember that sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Moffat renders this passage as a day's own trouble is quite enough for the day. And when you stop to think of it, isn't this true? We can readily understand from this that the miseries or woes of yesterday can enter today or tomorrow only through our memory. Before the end of yesterday, we should have put out of mind every disturbing thought caused by yesterday's situations. Those were yesterday's problems, so let them, along with yesterday, pass from sight and from memory. Let not the sun go down from your wrath is a mighty good bit of advice, or so it seems to me. We should not let the day close with our mind disturbed. It is too late to do anything about the way we let yesterday close. But we can do something about the way we let today close. Let us set today free in order that we may meet tomorrow, another new day, fresh and clean and unused, in the right spirit. Our wrath, mental disturbance, and physical miseries of yesterday have no place in our today. They only serve to crowd out the joys and blessings that are in store for us today. Each new day, a new world will begin for us if we do not carry into it the woes of yesterday. If we have not forgotten the woes of yesterday, we do not really experience a new day. To us, the day is just an extension of yesterday. When we let yesterday's sun go down, finding us wrathful and disturbed in mind, we are not obeying the biblical injunction to forget our miseries. We are not approaching a new day with a clear mind and a clean heart. The wisely given command to forget is a provision for our happiness. Were we to remember all our mistakes of the past, we should not have time to think of the good we want. Thou shalt forget thy misery. What shall we forget? What does the misery include? What comes under the category of wrath of mind? Everything not founded upon God or good and truth. It was meant that we should enjoy today to the exclusion of the wraths and miseries of yesterday. We are not to let one little rankling thought of yesterday sully the purity and beauty of today. You know, friends, the sleep that God gives us at night is but a form of His power to help us forget. Sleep is a vestibule through which we pass from one day to the next. We are to shed all our useless thoughts before we approach the next day. What of the wrongs that someone had committed against us yesterday or some other day? What of our jealousies and suspicions? What are the things we secretly accuse ourselves of? All these must go. We must forget them. They belong to the dream or nightmare of the past, in which we have awakened to a new day. Are you willing to obey the command, "Thou shalt forget thy miseries"? You alone can decide. You alone can reap the benefits of forgetting. You alone can decide whether you will spoil this new day, fresh and clean and unused, by harboring the adverse thoughts of yesterday. You alone can decide whether you will today remain in the wrathful state of mind of yesterday, or whether you will make the most of your present opportunities. The things of yesterday brought to your mind, which caused you to be disturbed, are quite insignificant today. Forget them. Learn to wipe from mind every thought that works against your highest good. Enjoy today to the fullest. You can do this only by approaching it with a clear mind, receptive to the good in store for you. Let each new day begin life anew for you, rather than being merely an extension of yesterday. Start out this morning by obeying the command to forget. Make up your mind you are not going to try to carry yesterday along into this brand new day. Erase from your mind any sense of blame, any memory of failure, all thoughts of wrongs of the past. Was it not Ruskin who said, "Let every dawn of morning be to you as the beginning of life, and every setting sun be to you as its close. Then let every one of these short lives leave its sure record of some kindly thing done for others, some goodly strength or knowledge gained for yourself. Let me repeat, let every dawn of morning be to you as the beginning of life, and every setting sun be to you as its close. Then let every one of these short lives leave its sure record of some kindly thing done for others, some goodly strength or knowledge gained for yourselves. It behooves all of us to live in the present in the way that will make of our future that which we wish our present were now. Yes, friends, it's up to us. We can go down into and wallow in impotent grief, or we can step upon the past to higher things. It is up to us. And so, friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Easton. This is UBC, the United Broadcasting Company.
So I wanted to tell a story that that really obsessed me when I was writing my new book, and it's a story of something that happened 3,000 years ago when the Kingdom of Israel was in its infancy. And it takes place in an area called the Shephelah in what is now Israel. And the reason the story obsessed me is that I thought I understood it, and then I went back over it and I realized that I didn't understand it at all. Ancient Palestine had along its eastern border, there's a mountain range, still same is true of Israel today. And in the mountain range are all of the ancient cities of that region. So Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron. And then there's a coastal plain right along the Mediterranean where Tel Aviv is now. And connecting the mountain range with the coastal plain is an area called the Shephelah, which is a series of valleys and ridges that run east to west. And you can follow the Shephelah, go through the Shephelah to get from the coastal plain to the mountains. And the Shephelah, if you've been to Israel, you'll know it's just about the most beautiful part of Israel. It's gorgeous with forests of oak and wheat fields and vineyards. But more importantly, though, in the history of that region, it's had a real strategic function. And that is, it is the means by which hostile armies on the coastal plain find their way, get up into the mountains and threaten those living in the mountains. And 3,000 years ago, that's exactly what happens. The Philistines, who are the biggest of enemies of the Kingdom of Israel, are living in the coastal plain. They're originally from Crete. They're a seafaring people. And they may start to make their way through one of the valleys of the Shephelah up into the mountains, because what they want to do is occupy the highland area right by Bethlehem and split the Kingdom of Israel in two. And the Kingdom of Israel, which is headed by King Saul, obviously catches wind of this, and Saul brings his army down from the mountains, and he confronts the Philistines in the Valley of Elah, one of the most beautiful of the valleys of the Shephelah. And the Israelites dig in along the northern ridge, and the Philistines dig in along the southern ridge, and the two armies just sit there for weeks and stare at each other because they're deadlocked. Neither can attack the other, because to attack the other side, you've got to come down the mountain into the valley and then up the other side, and you're completely exposed. So finally, to break the deadlock, the Philistines send their mightiest warrior down into the valley floor, and he calls out and he says to the Israelites, "Send your mightiest warrior down and we'll have this out, just the two of us." This was a tradition in ancient warfare called single combat. It was a way of settling disputes without incurring the bloodshed of a major battle. And the Philistine who is sent down, their mighty warrior, is a giant. He's 6'9". He's outfitted head to toe in this glittering bronze armor. And he's got a sword, and he's got a javelin, he's got a spear. He is absolutely terrifying. And he's so terrifying that none of the Israelite soldiers want to fight him. It's a death wish, right? There's no way they think they can take him. And finally, the only person who will come forward is this young shepherd boy. And he goes up to Saul, and he says, I'll fight him. And Saul says, you can't fight him. That's ridiculous. You're this kid. This is this mighty warrior. But the shepherd is adamant. He says, no, you don't understand. I have been defending my flock against lions and wolves for years. I think I can do it. And Saul has no choice. No one else has come forward. So he says, all right. And then he turns to the kid and he says, but you've got to wear this armor. You can't go as you are. So he tries to give the shepherd his armor, and the shepherd says, no. He says, I can't wear this stuff. The biblical verse is, I cannot wear this, for I have not proved it. Meaning, I've never worn armor before. You've got to be crazy. So he reaches down instead on the ground and picks up 5 stones and puts them in his shepherd's bag and starts to walk down the mountainside to meet the giant. And the giant sees this figure approaching and calls out, come to me so I can feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, right? He issues this kind of taunt towards this person coming to fight him. And the shepherd draws closer and closer, and the giant sees that he's carrying a staff. That's all he's carrying, right? Instead of a weapon, just this shepherd's staff. And he says, he's insulted. Am I a dog that you would come to me with sticks, right? And the shepherd boy takes one of his stones out of his pocket, puts it in his sling, and whirls it around and lets it fly, and hits the giant right between the eyes, like right here in his most vulnerable spot. And he falls down either dead or unconscious, and the shepherd boy runs up and takes his sword and cuts off his head. And the Philistines see this, and they turn and they just run. And of course, the name of the giant is Goliath, and the name of the shepherd boy is David. And the reason that story has obsessed me over the course of writing my book is that everything I thought I knew about that story turned out to be wrong. Right? So David in that story is supposed to be the underdog, right? In fact, that term, David and Goliath, has entered our language as a metaphor for improbable victories by some weak party over someone far stronger. Now, why do we call David an underdog? Well, we call him an underdog because he's a kid, little kid, and Goliath is this big, strong giant. We also call him an underdog because Goliath is an experienced warrior, and David is just a shepherd, right? But most importantly, we call him an underdog because all he has is that Goliath is outfitted with all of this modern weaponry, right? This glittering coat of armor and a sword and a javelin and a spear, and all David has is this sling. Well, let's start there with the phrase, all David has is this sling, because that's the first mistake that we make. In ancient warfare, there are 3 kinds of warriors. There's cavalry, men on horseback and with chariots. There is heavy infantry, which are foot soldiers, armed foot soldiers with swords and shields and some kind of armor. And there is artillery. And artillery are archers, but more importantly, slingers. And a slinger is someone who has a leather pouch with 2 long cords attached to it. And they put a projectile, either a rock or a lead ball, inside the pouch. And they whirl it around like this, and they let one of the cords go, and the effect is to send the projectile forward towards its target. Right? That's what David has. And it's important to understand that that sling is not a slingshot. It's not this, right? It's not a child's toy. It's, in fact, an incredibly devastating weapon. When David whirls it around like this, he's turning this thing around probably at 6 or 7 revolutions per second. And that means that when the rock is released, it's going forward really fast, probably 35 meters per second. That's substantially faster than baseball thrown by even the finest of baseball pitchers. More than that, The stones in the Valley of Elah were not normal rocks. They were barium sulfate, which are rocks twice the density of normal stones. If you do the calculations on the ballistic, on the stopping power of the rock fired from David's sling, it's roughly equal to the stopping power of a 45-millimeter handgun. Right? This is an incredibly devastating weapon. Accuracy, we know from historical records that slingers had, experienced slingers could hit and maim more serious or even kill a target at distances of up to 200 yards. From medieval tapestries, we know that slingers were capable of hitting birds in flight. They're incredibly accurate, right? When David lines up, and he's not 200 yards away from Goliath, he's quite close to Goliath. When he lines up and fires that thing at Goliath, he has every intention and every expectation of being able to hit Goliath at his most vulnerable spot between his eyes. If you go back over the history of ancient warfare, you will find time and time again that slingers were the decisive factor against infantry in one kind of battle, against heavy infantry in one kind of battle or another. So what's Goliath? He's heavy infantry. And his expectation when he challenges the Israelites to a duel is that he's going to be fighting another heavy infantryman, right? When he says, come to me that I might feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, the key phrase is come to me. Come up to me because we're going to fight hand to hand like this. Saul has the same expectation. David says, I want to fight Goliath, and Saul tries to give him his armor because Saul is thinking, oh, when you say fight Goliath, you mean fight him in hand-to-hand combat, infantry on infantry. But David has absolutely no expectation. No, he's not going to fight him that way. Why would he? He's a shepherd. He's spent his entire career using a sling to defend his flock against lions and wolves. That's where his strength lies. So here he is, this shepherd, experienced in the use of a devastating weapon, up against this lumbering giant weighed down by 100 pounds of armor and these incredibly heavy weapons that are useful only in short-range combat. Goliath is a sitting duck. He doesn't have a chance, right? So why do we keep calling David an underdog, and why do we keep referring to his victory as improbable? The second piece of this that's important. It's not just that we misunderstand David and his choice of weaponry. It's also that we profoundly misunderstand Goliath. Goliath is not what he seems to be. There's all kinds of hints of this in the biblical text. Things that are, in retrospect, are quite puzzling and don't square with his image as this mighty warrior. So to begin with, the Bible says that Goliath is led onto the valley floor by an attendant. Now that is weird, right? Here is this mighty warrior going, challenging the Israelites to one-on-one combat. Why is he being led by the hand, by some, you know, young boy, presumably, to the point of combat? Secondly, the Bible story makes special note of how slowly Goliath moves. Another odd thing to say when you're describing the mightiest warrior known to man at that point, right? And then there's this whole weird thing about how long it takes Goliath to react to the sight of David. So David's coming down the mountain, and he's clearly not preparing for hand-to-hand combat, right? There's nothing about him that says, I'm about to fight you like this. He's not even carrying a sword. Why does Goliath not react to that? It's as if he's oblivious to what's going on that day. And then there's that strange comment he makes to David. Am I a dog that you should come to me with sticks? Right? Sticks? David only has one stick. Well, it turns out that there's been a great deal of speculation within the medical community over the years about whether there's something fundamentally wrong with Goliath, an attempt to make sense of all of those apparent anomalies. There have been many articles written. The first one was in 1960 in the Indiana Medical Journal, and it started a chain of speculation that starts with an explanation for Goliath's height. So Goliath is head and shoulders above all of his peers in that era. And usually when someone is that far out of the norm, there's an explanation for it. So the most common form of giantism is a condition called acromegaly. An acromegaly is caused by a benign tumor on your pituitary gland that causes an overproduction of human growth hormone. And throughout history, many of the most famous giants have all had acromegaly. So the tallest person of all time was a guy named Robert Wadlow, who was still growing when he died at the age of 24, and he was 8 foot 11. He had acromegaly. Do you remember the wrestler Andre the Giant, famous? He had acromegaly. There's even speculation that Abraham Lincoln had acromegaly. Right? Anyone who's unusually tall, that's the first explanation we come up with. And acromegaly has a very distinct set of side effects associated with it, principally having to do with vision. The pituitary tumor, as it grows, often starts to compress the visual nerves in your brain, with the result that people with acromegaly have either double vision or they are profoundly nearsighted. So when people have started to speculate about what might have been wrong with Goliath, they said, wait a minute, he looks and sounds an awful lot like someone who has acromegaly. And that would also explain so much of what was strange about his behavior that day, right? Why does he move so slowly and have to be escorted down into the valley floor by an attendant? Because he can't make his way on his own, right? Why is he so strangely oblivious to David that he doesn't understand that David's not going to fight him until the very last moment? Because he can't see him, right? When he says, come to me that I might feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, the phrase come to me is a hint also of his vulnerability. Come to me because I can't see you, right? And then there's, am I a dog that you should come to me with sticks? He sees two sticks when David has only one. So the Israelites up on the mountain ridge looking down on him thought he was this extraordinarily powerful foe. What they didn't understand was that the very thing that was the source of his apparent strength was also the source of his greatest weakness. And there is, I think, in that a very important lesson for all of us. Giants are not as strong and powerful as they seem. And sometimes the shepherd boy has a sling in his pocket.
When things go wrong, as they sometimes will, when the road you're trudging seems all uphill, when the funds are low and the debts are high, and you want to smile but have to sigh, when care is pressing you down a bit, rest if you must, but don't you quit. Life is queer with its twists and turns, as every one of us sometimes learns. And many a failure turns about when he might have won if he'd stuck it out. Don't give up though the pace seems slow. You might succeed with another blow. Often the struggler has given up when he might have captured the victor's cup. And he learned too late when the night slipped down how close he was to the golden crown. Success is failure turned inside out. The silver tint of clouds of doubt, and you never can tell how close you are. You may be near when it seems afar. So stick to the fight when your heart is hit. It's when things seem worst that you mustn't quit.
E-commerce develops rapidly in China. It demonstrates that the transition from physical to digital commerce, often perceived as a phenomenon of high-income countries, can happen in a country at a lower level of development as well. The World Bank and the Alibaba Group launched a joint research initiative to examine how China has harnessed digital technologies to aid growth and expand employment opportunities through e-commerce development in rural areas. Taobao villages are villages significantly engaged in e-commerce, with total annual e-commerce transaction volume of at least RMB 10 million, with at least 100 active online shops. The number of Taobao villages increased from 20 in 2013 to 1,311 in 2016 and to 2,118 in 2017. The World Bank Alibaba Joint Research Team, in collaboration with Peking University, conducted a survey in rural China covering 1,400 households and 80 Taobao villages significantly engaged in e-commerce. The analysis finds that rural areas with good infrastructure and good access to markets tend to be most conducive to e-commerce. More than half of people in Taobao villages use internet. People with higher education are more likely to use internet, particularly for work and learning-related activities. The internet penetrates people's lives with news, entertainment, online shopping, work, and education. Most people, especially e-households in Taobao villages, perceive their social status as equal or higher compared with 5 years ago, and they believe they have equal or even higher social status 2 years in the future. E-households are richer than other households. Business income, including e-commerce income, is the main income source of e-households. E-shop owners are younger and more educated than the rest of the population in the village. Many e-shop owners are returned migrants and women. Most e-shops are small. E-shop workers in Taobao villages have wage levels equal to or higher than workers in urban private industries. High cost of online advertisement, tough competition, and lack of skills are considered by e-shop owners the top three obstacles to developing e-commerce. Access to finance remained an important constraint. The majority of e-households have never borrowed for operations or only borrowed from household members, friends, and relatives. For those who borrowed, Ant Financial, followed by banks and other financing platforms, are important sources of financing. Many anecdotal cases show that e-commerce play a positive role in people's lives. The future research agenda includes how can e-commerce development be furthered as an instrument for poverty reduction and shared prosperity? How can the lessons of rural China be used to inspire other countries to seek unconventional solutions and a wider set of partners to tackle persistent challenges?
Hello, my name is James Robson, and I'm the Victor and William Fung Director of the Harvard Asia Center. I'd like to welcome you to the Asia Center's Research Talk Series. The research talks are aimed at showcasing some of the fascinating research that's being done on various facets of Asia by Harvard students, graduate students, faculty, Asia Center affiliates, and other specialists. We very much hope you enjoyed learning from these talks.
Hi, everybody. My broad interest is on entrepreneurship and what impact it can have on growth and inequality, which naturally means my curiosity is much more on developing countries and specifically on China. My more recent research curiosity is essentially to inquire on what role can technology play in promoting grassroots type of entrepreneurship for growth and development. One of the most promising areas of interest in entrepreneurship is that of entrepreneurial ecosystems. It holds interest not only for academics, but also from policymakers because of the promise that entrepreneurial ecosystems hold for promoting a dynamic, sustainable economic growth. An entrepreneurial ecosystem comprises of individual elements which combine and interact in complex ways, and together these elements turbocharge venture creation and growth. With their promise of growth and job creation, naturally, entrepreneurial ecosystems have attracted the attention of government and local authorities worldwide. And it enjoys a huge amount of public support. My current research addresses two concerns within the field of entrepreneurial ecosystems. First, I try to address a general bias in the entrepreneurship literature given its focus, its Western-centric focus. This is true not only for entrepreneurship in general, but also for entrepreneurial ecosystems, which has largely held up a Silicon Valley type of growth as its model. Recently, authors have stressed the importance of studying entrepreneurship phenomenon in emerging countries, and as it is one of the most understudied but important global economic phenomenon today. Second, technology has become one of the threads from which the fabric of organization is now woven. And while digital technologies are shaping entrepreneurial opportunities, decisions, actions, and outcome, the question is, what role does it play in promoting entrepreneurial ecosystems? The phenomenon that I focus now in my ongoing research is that of Taobao villages in China. With the accelerated penetration of high-speed internet in rural China, a new and distinct entrepreneurial phenomenon has risen from within rural China, which is largely considered or baptized as the Taobao villages. The exponential growth of China's e-commerce has enabled the Chinese not only to buy online, but platforms like Taobao.com, which is owned by Alibaba, have also created new opportunities for entrepreneurs and small firms to sell their products and often services online. Opening up an online store entails no fees, nor do platforms take any cuts from the online transactions, unlike, for example, Amazon. Rural Chinese have leveraged this digital phenomenon to sell, and thus the phenomenon of Taobao villages have quickly flourished. Ali Research, the Taobao arm of Alibaba Group, considers Taobao villages as those where at least 10% of the households in a village engage in e-commerce and have annual online sales of at least 10 million yuan, which is approximately $1.5 million. The concept of Taobao villages first appeared about 12 years back when it was decided what criteria has to be met. Soon, entrepreneurs, mostly farmers, leveraged their technology to sell their products online. Taobao villages quickly diffused across the country. The Taobao villages exploited economies of agglomeration, and sellers from Taobao villages became even more competitive on e-commerce platforms. An associated phenomenon is that of Taobao towns, which quickly emerged, which is a township or street that consists of at least three such Taobao villages. A larger agglomeration of Taobao towns form the Taobao village clusters. When there exists a cluster of more than 10 neighboring Taobao villages that together practice e-commerce, and entrepreneurs leverage the Taobao Alibaba platform to sell the products and services. So this phenomenon, which is about 12 years or 13 years old, has having a transformative effect in rural China. The number of Taobao villages and Taobao towns in China rose to more than 5,400 from about 1,756, about 20-25% over the previous years. China's one village, one product policy, ongoing since 2007, had earlier laid the foundations of specialization, encouraging every village to develop locally distinguishable products. This story can be traced, the phenomenon of Taobao villages can be traced down to one village, the Dongwang village in Shaji town, which was the first rural village to take up e-commerce on a large scale. Shaji is a small town of a population of about 50,000, located in Jiangsu province. In 2010, the Alibaba research team was surprised when a large dot showed up in their visualization map, which showed a strong e-commerce activity. They went down to verify, and they found a very interesting phenomenon. But it started with just one entrepreneur, a Shaji native, San Han, left his village to study and ended up working on several jobs before deciding to come back to his hometown. In 2006, he bought a computer and opened the first online Taobao shop in the town, reselling mobile phone accessories, which were sourced from his friends he had made in Guangzhou. Although the business was not going so well, he became inspired from a visit to an IKEA store in Shanghai, where flat-pack furniture was becoming popular among the emerging middle class in China. He bought a few pieces and brought them back to Shaji. He then worked with local carpenters to craft their own furniture versions and put them on sale in his Taobao shop. In a very short period of time, sales boomed, requiring him to hire other villages. Inspired by their success, other villages imitated, and eventually they started opening up their own e-commerce stores, mostly based on furniture. There are many such examples showing how e-commerce has allowed locals to build their own profitable business. For example, Mrs. Kai, also from Shaji, a peasant in a poor village, she became a restaurant owner in just 10 years, a very successful one at that. This was possible due to the engagement in e-commerce for furniture, which she got through a cousin. She worked with other people before she opened up her own Taobao store. Her business grew to have 30 employees and about millions of RMB in revenue. She was unable to buy two houses to allow her son to have a good education and open up her own restaurant. This is just one of thousands of examples spread throughout rural China, where the abundance of open technology platforms and collaborations among villagers are changing the lives of millions. So what's happening? One person, then neighbors, then the whole village, and then a cluster of villages and towns. Alibaba and Taobao are changing rural China the ways many of us do not know. It's a bottom-up model. In entrepreneurial ecosystems, we speak about the strong role of the government, where the government is a promoter. This is not the case. It's these small entrepreneurs from rural villages who are selling, often using live stream to promote their goods and services. Second, it's an emergence of an ecosystem of varied actors for delivery, website creation, packaging, logistics, and so on. Third, there are low barriers and inspiration is taken and not just imitation, which follows a certain pattern, and very soon villages start to specialize. Fourth, the government's role here is as a facilitator of providing good quality infrastructure, roads, electricity, telecoms, and so on. Fifth, with the annual transaction volume of Taobao villages and Taobao town online exceeding RMB 1 trillion, more migrant workers are returning to their hometown to start their own businesses. Sixth, with close to 3 million online stores creating over 8.2 million jobs, it's transforming rural villages. More than 50% of Taobao villages are located in western and central China, where much of the poorer people in China live. Seventh, the wide coverage of digital infrastructure has made available new jobs and entrepreneurship opportunities for marginalized people in remote mountainous areas during the pandemic. This is a work in progress. I have collected quite a lot of information and data via secondary sources and some interviews. Unfortunately, due to the pandemic, I have not been able to visit many more villages than I want to. Hopefully, when China opens up for tourists and researchers, my work will continue next year. And it's a work in progress. And I like to show through my research how entrepreneurial ecosystems are transforming the lives of poor people in ways nobody would have imagined. And digital infrastructure provided the affordance for such a transformation. Thank you so much.
You mentioned Taobao a couple of times too. So tell us a little bit about that and how they came to be and how Alibaba played a part in that.
Well, so Taobao was really the retail e-commerce arm of Alibaba Group. And it was started initially because of the fear that, eBay, if they came into the China market, they would really not only take the consumer marketplace, but they might actually move into other areas that were competitive with Alibaba Group. More importantly was the realization that the Chinese consumers did not have access to products that the rest of the world did because they had such a rudimentary retail, like I talked about earlier, infrastructure system. So I think a big driver too, beyond just the competitive aspects, was that consumers in China had curiosity and desire to access products from all over the world, but they weren't able to do that through the traditional means. So how do we actually give them access to that through the internet? And one of the things that people always talk about at eBay is that they had 95% market share at the time that Taobao got started. That's true if you look at the addressable market that was already online and already purchasing products. But if you look at the addressable market, which was 90, so that's probably like 3 to 4 million, I guess, at that time. But if you look at the addressable market that was already online in, say, 2003, 2004, it was like 90 million, okay? And you could say, well, that's the market that we're trying to address and provide them access to these products. But if you take a step back further and say, no, actually, the addressable market is not just those who are online, but actually the entire sort of retail market, that was at the time like 700-800 million. And so what Taobao really thought about is, how do we serve this 700-800 million people that want access to all these products but don't know how to find it? That's what we're creating for them. And that marketing approach was dramatically different from what you would do if you were like just competing with eBay. We actually used the same process we did with B2B, educate the market through very traditional means. Like, we'd have seminars, we'd do a lot of offline stuff to kind of educate the normal Chinese consumer that Taobao was the place to find anything from anywhere. And you can do that all through your internet. So in a way, we drove the adoption and the use of the internet for retail consumption.
How is it doing today?
Oh, so today it's like over a billion users and over $1 trillion in gross merchandise value. So it's by far the largest in the world. And that, again, is the result of kind of this evolution of this ecosystem that Alibaba Group really helped to catalyze.
You must be familiar with Taobao, Chinese online shopping website and one of the largest e-commerce websites in the world. But do you know Taobao Village? Who are the merchants? What do they sell? And how do they sell?
Now I'm in Xichenbo Village, one of the Taobao villages in Suning County, and they're selling fishing gears.
因为我们这个镇呢本身就是有做玉根的这个传统的这个产业，所以呢当时我们就选取了玉根。当时呢因为我们家2012年做了之后呢，当时开了一个店铺，接着呢两个三个，那生意做好了之后呢，那需要的人也就多了，所以说我们附近的这些村民呢，我就叫给他们来，来给帮忙了。一个是收入比他种的还多呢。
Live streaming. Actually, I'm not surprised to see this in Taobao Village since it has played such an important role in e-commerce, especially during the epidemic. Can I have a try? According to the Alibaba Research Institute, a Taobao village is one that has annual e-commerce sales of at least 10 million yuan, or at least 100 active online stores, or whose active online stores account for at least 10% of the total village households. This is a local brand of fishing gears in Hanan Village. 咱们这个一般这一个月销量得有多少啊？
现在一个月的销量就是这款鱼竿单品的话，应该在7万只左右。
就这一款就7万只。哎，对，是的，是的。
在咱们当地这个村子里面吧，有90%的人都在从事电商淘宝这一块。咱们现在这个厂子里面呢，所有的工人都是咱们当地人，100%的咱们当地人。很重要的一点是，如果说在咱们当地上班，在挣的钱差不多的前提下，他能守着自己的家里人，守着自己的孩子，这对于他们来说，这是一种享受，我感觉。
In the village, we can see that almost all businesses are operated by family members or neighbors. They build their factory here and they just work from home. It's at such a low budget. Besides veggies and other agricultural products, they also sell clothes here in Taobao Village.
因为我们这个地区的电商比较发达，像我们的员工都是这个周边的，他们也不用出去打工了。
This whole building is designed for live stream. They're doing live stream in each room to sell their products, clothes, t-shirt, hoodie online. Let's have a look. Because of these Taobao villages here, they have such a big delivery center to support the package express service in Suning County. In the next 10 years, it's estimated that there will be more than 20,000 Taobao villages across the country, creating more than 20 million job opportunities to attract more young people to their hometowns to start businesses.
How many of you want to live in a tiny house off-grid? Capture your own rainwater in a huge rain catchment system. Run all of your electricity needs completely off solar. Finance your land for 10 years and get it paid off quicker if possible. Yes, there's still going to be land taxes. Welcome to America. But your cost of living is almost going to be nothing compared to what you're paying now. I still ain't bought into the electric car thing yet. So some of the big questions are, how did you do it? How do you live off-grid? Okay, so what did I do? How did I do it? In 2013, I got online and I started looking for land for sale. What I was really looking for was off-grid land or just hunting land. It didn't take long and I found some desert land in West Texas that was really cheap. After doing a little investigation on the rainfall only being about 12 inches a year, I decided against that and I figured out that's pretty much why the property was so cheap. So I literally Googled up, where's the best place to live off-grid in the United States? Not only did I find what I was looking for, I was told the counties that were the best in the United States to go off-grid in. Okay, Google, good off-grid property in this certain county. And guess what I found? We finance land ourselves, in-house finance. No credit, bad credit, nothing needed, just your down payment. So being a man with bad credit at the time, what do you think I did? So I got on their website and I looked up the counties I was talking about. Found several properties in those counties. And you know, a lot of this stuff is old logging land that had already been logged. I mean, it didn't bother me. It was beautiful. The owners of the company and the property were so nice that they said, if you want to and you have an RV or a tent or something like that, you can actually go out there and pitch your tent or pull your RV out there and stay a few days and see how you like it. See if you want to buy it. Well, I know this part right here doesn't sound good if you got good credit, but it sounds great if you were in a situation like I was in. 10% annual interest. If you do the math on that and you understand what that is, it's kind of tough, but I did it. 10 years has gone by. I've done a whole lot of improvements, and I paid it off. Not only did I pay it off, I put that tiny house on it, and I did a bunch of, So I did a bunch of other things that was good for a hunting property, and I thought, man, if things ever went bad in the United States and we went to war or we had civil unrest or anything like that, my property would be the perfect place to be. I'm glad I got this thing. So that was my kind of train of thought. Needless to say, I eventually paid it off. I got the deed, and I know you're like, well, how can I do this? Okay, well, first off, you have to pick what state you want to be in and what state you want to do this in. Second off, I would do my research on what states have the least regulations of living off-grid, which states will actually let you capture rainwater, which states will actually let you use solar panels, which states will actually let you dig your own well if you desire to. Did I mention which state has the lowest property taxes? Look, man, I'm not saying I did it perfect. I'm not even saying I did it the way you would do it. What I'm saying is this is how I did it, and this is a way that you can try for yourself. When I made the short video about it, it was blowing up, and it still is blowing up. And that's the reason why I'm making this video here, because I want to answer some of y'all's questions that you have. I mean, I don't want this all to my own. If this can help somebody out, I mean, I want other people to do the same thing. I want other people to live their life, have a good life. You work 30, 35 years to pay off a house, a mortgage nowadays, and then you pay $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a year in taxes for that house after it's paid. Seems like a lot of times it's people's dream to just have a small cabin out on a bunch of acreage, or just to have a small cabin out on 5 acres. People would be happy with that. That's what I keep hearing anyways. Now, let's get into some of the details of how I did it. Okay, true story. A lot of you didn't believe, but this house cost me right at $8,400. I went and I paid cash for it. I bought a travel trailer for $3,000. I fixed it up and I turned it for $8,500. So I went straight down and bought this house. This house was a shell. It has no interior. It's just a shell, if you know what that is. Now, I'm going to show you where you get these type of houses. Do you ever look on the side of the road and you see those shed-to-house type things? Or even you see buildings like Graceland, or, you know, places where you see them building a shed. And usually it's in the county and they've got them lined up on some property and you're driving down the highway and you see a few of them lined up out there for sale. Well, that's what we kind of got going on here. I'm not saying that you can get this house for $8,400 anymore. That was 2 years ago. But you might be able to get one similar like it for about $10,000 or $12,000. You don't have to have credit to get one of these, and you don't have to have the cash to get one. They let you make payments on them. You just put a down payment, and they'll deliver it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not even saying that you have to live off-grid, but you can buy a property like this, and you can have it as a hunting property, and you can just keep it for hunting. And I guess if things went bad and, you know, that TF thing happens, I guess you could go out there and take your family out there and maybe prepare in that kind of sense, you know. So what is the status of my batteries now at about 3 p.m.? Let's check it out and see. I don't know if you can see it or if there's too much of a glare, but it says 329 watts are coming in and the batteries are in float.
sitting at 6.1 amps. 54 volts is where it's at. It's basically telling us that the house is being ran completely off of the solar panels right now, and we're only pulling 328 watts, and the batteries are just totally topped off. They're sitting here totally floating. Nothing's being pulled from the batteries. Everything that's being pulled in the house, like the refrigerator and the fan and the other things, electric water pump and all that, whenever it turns on, all those things are being ran right now by the solar panels themselves.
A few people have been asking, will it run the air conditioner? Yes, it'll run the air conditioner, especially during the daytime. It has no problem at all running the air conditioner. The air conditioner pulls about 550 watts, and we're bringing in 3,200 watts when we need it. So, yeah, it has no problem running the refrigerator, the air conditioner, the fan, and several other things. Whatever you want to run, it'll run. I run my power tools when I'm out working. I run my shop and my shop lights and any tools that I have in the shop. So, yeah, I'm not going to lie. It's a peaceful place to be. And it's a nice place to call home. It's a nice place to kick back and relax. It's a beautiful day out here today. The wife's not here today. I kind of wish she was. She would enjoy this weather. A lot of people keep asking about that garden. Yes, I want to do a garden someday. Yes, but I don't have a garden yet. I don't have animals yet and all that. And yes, someday I want to have animals, especially chickens and things like that, where we can have our own eggs. But I'm just not to that point yet.
Okay, let's check out some details on my rainwater catchment system. So this is the 6,000-gallon water tank that I harvest the rainwater in. I got this tank on a trade for a golf cart for $200. I towed it about 250 miles on a 16-foot trailer. These are the gutters and the gutter guards, which you can see are clearly doing their job this year. And this is where it comes together and runs into the tank. On the back side of the water tank here is the water pump house. This has my pump, filter, and water pressure tank inside it. The small black tank that you see is a 500-gallon overflow tank. This water tank full would weigh about 40,000 pounds. I shock it twice a year with about 4 gallons of bleach each time, depending on how much rain has been flowing through it. I installed the wood stove in this chimney pipe. I got the wood stove used for about $200. The chimney parts were really expensive. They cost me about $600. And I mean, this is me doing all this myself.
I appreciate all y'all watching. If you do leave a comment, I answer almost every one of them back. The rude and crude ones, I don't really answer back, but I like to answer back to everybody and talk to everybody and stay interactive with everybody. So if you want to leave a comment, more than likely I'm going to respond to you. Okay, guys, until next time, we'll see you later.
Okay, this week, as a matter of fact, today's live stream is titled, and it's the theme for this entire week, is 1 acre. 1 acre. Now, I'm in Florida, of course. We're looking for, well, I'm not looking, but we're on a lookout for and tracking Hurricane Milton. 2 weeks ago it was Helene, now it's Milton. So hopefully we'll have an uninterrupted week of doing podcasts at our regular time as we do every week. Anyway, with that said, because it's Monday, our whole series or theme for this week is 1 acre. So we're in the process of buying some additional acres of land in Oklahoma. But I figure before we lay out that whole project, we need to educate a person on exactly what is an acre. Now, we've all heard of the term acre. In some parts of the world, they use hectares, and hectares are like almost double the size, not quite double, but the size of an acre. But what is an acre? All right, so all this week, and then we're writing a ebook, a short ebook, something, you know, 10 to no more than 15 pages, something that a person can quickly read in a sitting. All right, and something that anywhere from an 8-year-old, somebody in third grade, 8 years old, 8, 9 years old, whatever those ages are, can remember. All right, in process. So everybody has walked on acres, driven on acres, open field of acres and acres and acres of land. Food comes out of the ground grown on acres. There, I mean, where you live, a house or apartment, that's built on a certain amount of acres. But they don't really know what an acre is. So tomorrow, I mean, all this week, it's 1 acre week because we're in the process of acquiring 12 acres. But to simplify, you know, what's an acre and what can I do with an acre of land? You know, what's in an acre of land? When you see an open field, that's an acre big. And I can tell you this right now, and you hear this every day this week. An acre is about the size of a football field, an American, like, college or high school football field. That's 1 acre of land. Or on a pro level, you know, take out the goal, the end zones, and from goalpost to goalpost, you know, you got an acre of land. So that's a visual for some of you that want to, get a visual on it. What can you put on an acre of land? Well, you can put 9 basketball courts on an acre of land. You can put 16 tennis courts on an acre of land. You can feed families off of 1 acre of land. So all this week, there's a lot to deal with just on 1 acre. So that's why we're taking, today's just an introduction, but Monday, so we're doing 4 days to give you information that most people just did not know on what they can do with just 1 acre of land, and then what you can do if you want to acquire an acre of land. Matter of fact, let me throw this out there. I bought 10 acres of land in West Texas, extreme West Texas. Yeah, is that extreme West Texas? You may as well call it that. Well, I'll just say West Texas, about 8 years ago, for $200 an acre. All right. Now, so, however, switching geographical locations, depending on where you are within the city proper of Chicago, Illinois, an acre of land, and we're talking about with nothing on it, with no buildings on it, all right, the $200 an acre that I bought in West Texas, it has nothing on it. But an acre of land in the city of Chicago, if you can find an acre of land that's vacant in the city of Chicago, is worth anywhere from $1 million to $3 million. Same dimensions. Acre, 43,560 square feet. That's an acre. So this week we'll be going through, why the price, differences, what makes this acre technically more valuable than the other place. Now, for me personally, the $200 per acre is more valuable to me and a whole lot of other people like me versus the $1 million to $3 million acre. It all depends on what you want to do with that 1 acre. And like I say, acre is about the size of a football field. All right, so like I say, tomorrow, I'm working on an ebook. The ebook is titled 1 Acre. So tomorrow, we will have chapter 1, and they basically are 1-page chapters, maybe 2 pages at the most, but typically what I told you, we want it real simple, something that I'm going to say a third grader can digest. Third grader, something that's simplified that a fifth to eighth grader can digest. by fifth grade, really probably even third grade, but definitely fifth grade, fourth or fifth grade, we've written our first book report. All right, so, and that's what an e-book basically is today, a glorified book report, at least the short one. So, 1 Acre is the name of the book, and tomorrow I'll give you chapter one. I have an outline already, but, you know, some of those chapters, I mean, some of those ideas I might be merged into, because I'm trying to keep it short to 10 to, at the extreme, 15 pages. And I don't think a fifth to eighth grader might be patient enough to deal with 15 pages. But you know, those Tom Swift books and the Parker Brother books and Nancy Drew books, those books, matter of fact, you know what? Let me do some on-air research right now. Let me go with Dr. Seuss's. I remember that Hop on Pop, Green Eggs and Ham. How many pages was that book? Although this won't be as elementary as those books. You know, See Dick Run, See Spot Run, Sally, See Sally Walk. You know, no, it won't. Won't be. Oh, let me do this on my laptop. Let's see. Yeah, so it's 1 acre week, and we're going to have 1 acre retreat, 1 acre. Matter of fact, tomorrow morning, we'll be here as usual, but we're also doing StreamYard, so I'll be visual tomorrow, me and one other person. So we'll be visual tomorrow. Same time, now we won't be playing, you know, the audios like we do here. We'll probably be playing somebody else's audio. But tomorrow we'll be live and in living color. We're live right now, and we're living, but the color part, so that's tomorrow. So we'll it'll be on StreamYard, but I'll be tuned into this, you know, here on Blog Talk. So you can, if you want to see the visual and even participate, that's tomorrow morning, same time. And once you get here, we'll give you the particulars. All right, how many pages is Hop on Pop? It's 64 pages. That's a Dr. Seuss book. Okay, now let's go to how many pages, what do they call it, Dick and Jane books? Is a Dick and Jane, I wonder if they still publish those books. Okay, I know we don't want Nancy Drew. Dick, all right, The World of Dick and Jane. All right, for 5 and 6 year olds, 44 pages. Okay, 44 to 6. So that's Dick and Jane. That's first grade. This is going to be 10 to 15 pages top, aimed at, now we won't go as rudimentary, in other words, you know what? That might, you know what? That gives me an idea. No sense in reinventing the wheel. Here's an acre. I'm writing this book out loud. Okay. Although I got stuff written on my laptop already. 1 acre. You know, and then give pictures. That's the rest of my homework assignment for today. So tomorrow, once again, this is 1 acre week. We want to organize a 12-acre village within a town in the state of Oklahoma. So, but we you got to get educated on what is an acre first. So be ready for class tomorrow morning, and we'll have stuff online, and we'll cover chapter one tomorrow, right here on Blog Talk Radio, as well as StreamYard, which means we'll be on Facebook Live, we'll be on, we'll be here live, but the visual part will be on Facebook Live with a visual, as well as YouTube Live on a visual, and then probably one or two other platforms. So we'll be on about four or five platforms tomorrow, on including right here on Blog Talk. But three or four of those platforms, you'll be able to see us. So that's tomorrow, 1 acre of chapter one of 1 acre week. All right, that's the intro. What is it? What time? It is, oh, wait a minute. That's 8 or after 12 already. On that note, everybody have a good rest of the day and see you tomorrow.
At Jiffy Lube, we car about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking care of business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.